Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Leonard S. Marcus, one of the world's leading writers about children's books and the people who create them. He's a writer, essayist, interviewer, and teacher. And we're talking about his book that he compiled and edited. You can't say that! Writers for Young People talk about censorship, free expression, and the stories they have to tell. Leonard, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, thank you for having me, Mark.
This is, first of all, I want to say that I really loved the dedication to your uncle, Abe Friedman.
He was a real character. He was married to one of my mother's older sisters, and she was the bohemian of the family. And he himself was a Fabian socialist. He'd come over from England, was totally self-educated, was politically radical, and he collected, as kind of an expression of his love of learning, he collected first editions of Dickens and other writers, and it's one of the people who got a hold of Ulysses before it was legal to own a copy.
All right.
So I thought, who better than him?
This is an amazing book, and I really strongly want to encourage people to read this book. There are interviews that you did with authors of books for young people about their experiences of getting banned or censored, and each story is unique. And reasons why they were censored and unique, and we'll talk about that. In the introduction, you actually sort of briefly trace the history of censorship in America. Is it true that since the 1980s, attempts at censorship have increased?
The 80s was one of the times when it became very organized. I think over the long arc of American history, more often than not, it has been very decentralized, and would be something happening at one particular school or library somewhere in the country. But in the 80s, you had Phyllis Schlafly and Moral Majority,
yep.
And they were really trying to make a national effort to keep certain books out of children's hands. Judy Blume being one of the favorite targets.
What's amazing is that it seems to even have picked up pace in the last 5 years. I mean, that Matt Krause banned book list with 850 titles on it, The Texas Lawmaker, I mean, that was insane. I actually read the list.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He hasn't read three quarters of those books, I guarantee it.
And that's a characteristic of the people who try to ban books in America. Very often, when it comes to having a public hearing, which is part of the process that the American Library Association recommended when a parent or somebody else wants to challenge a book at a school or library, often there's a public hearing. And it usually comes out that the people making the criticism have not actually read the book.
Well, that came true of several of the people that you talked to, including most humorously Dave Pilkey. It was so obvious that the person was getting on about him about kids in underwear had not read the Captain Underpants books.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, really appreciating, enjoying, understanding literature is all about context. And what the censors often do is to pull the books out of context in order to achieve some, objective of their own.
It was amazing to me reading that long list about how many of them had to do with gay issues.
The two really intense targets in recent years have been books having to do with gender and sexuality and race. And if all you have to do is pick up the newspaper or put on the radio, and you can see why. Those are the things that people are scared to death about. And behind a lot, if not all, of these efforts is fear of loss of control, either of one's own child or of, however the community or country is defined, and those are really big issues in America now. That's what we're saying.
Well, as you clearly write in your book, you're not against impassioned discussions. This is a quote about a controversial book in which each side respects the other, but these good faith arguments now can rarely happen.
Maybe it's Pollyanna-ish, but I always thought America was about pluralism and tolerance, if not acceptance, of other people's views. And that's what is often lacking when people feel they have to just move in with a sort of power move and try to pull a book out of a school or a library.
One of the most important things you say in the beginning is that the human costs of censorship tend to remain hidden. Elaborate on that.
Yeah, and that's why it took me so long to finish this book, because there are the visible attempts at censorship. When somebody makes a public statement, they go into a library and demand that a book be removed or something of that sort. But much more often, other things are happening, almost like background noise, and that is often where the cost lies. For example, if a librarian orders a book which proves to be controversial within its community, people may object, and then that librarian may have to face antagonistic people at the grocery store the next day, or may be forced from his or her job, or word of what's happening in that community might reach the publisher, and the publisher might think, well, you know, maybe I'm not going to publish the next book by that author, or the author feels, I caused so much trouble for that librarian. Maybe the next time I write a book, I should try to be a little more careful about what I say. So there's self-censorship. There's what is sometimes called soft censorship. And it reverberates throughout the whole system, from the person who creates the book down to the people who make it available to the public.
What is the Office for Intellectual Freedom?
It's an office within the American Library Association. And ALA is the professional national organization for people, librarians of all descriptions. Children's and teen librarians are a very large constituency within ALA. And a number of years ago, when there was a big uptick in challenges to books around the country, challenges to libraries and school libraries, ALA decided that it wanted to be proactive and to create standards for thinking about, for educating people about what the First Amendment protects people from in the way of one person imposing their preferences on another. And they created a kind of model for how a community could deal with a challenge once it arose.
Well,
everyone would have a say, you know.
That was what was amazing to me in this book, was reading how often the public libraries were like the first line of defense in intellectual freedom.
Yeah. Well, people pay taxes that support the libraries, and so they feel they have a right to express their opinion, which is certainly true. But I think, you know, they go too far when they feel they have the right not only to decide what their own children might read, but also what every other child in the community might have access to. Well, and there's a presumption, you know, that librarians are honest brokers of the culture, you know, and that when they make choices for a library collection, they're already taking into account the community's interests in the broadest possible sense. There's a wonderful story in the book, a librarian who told one of the authors, you know, she said, I wouldn't have your books in my home for my child, but I feel that it's a serious book. These are serious books, and therefore the children of the community deserve to have the opportunity to know about them.
Well, for me, this is why these cases of attempted censorship and have always broken down. Like, I totally get you may not want your child to read a certain book, but why you must then prevent every other child within your area from reading that book is where it totally breaks down for me.
Right. It really boils down to this idea of pluralism, I think. You know, if you accept that America is a place where people of different opinions and different ideas are able to come together, then you have to acknowledge that there are going to be some books and some ideas that you disagree with, but which should nevertheless be accessible to everyone to make their own judgment. And that's where it breaks down. People just want it their own way or no way.
Well, what I found really strange were there were several cases where the people illegally took the books out of the library and then had the gall to actually offer to pay the library back for
right.
the books.
That's right. And they thought that was an adequate solution. But, you know, to their credit, and because they were professionals, the library said, we're not a bookstore. You know, we have made a judgment based on reviews and reading and thinking that these books are worthy of being available to the public. And, you know, that person was in the wrong. And in one case, I think it was in Vermont, the person who did that repeatedly was prosecuted successfully.
Theft
of public property.
Now, this series of interviews, several of them, you actually talked to the people because you both were at a conference about censorship.
Yes. Books for children and teens are the most frequently challenged books of all categories in America, and this has been true for a long time. And that might be surprising to some people because, I mean, when I, you know, would see my extended family around the Thanksgiving Day dinner table, and they asked me what I was doing, you know, to make a living, and told them I was writing about children's books, they would often give me a funny look, like, you know, why would that be a serious thing to do?
Oh,
but
wow.
In fact, people, you know, when it comes down to it, see children's books as having an incredible impact, or potentially so, and often an exaggerated impact. I mean, for example, the book Heather Has Two Mommies is a picture book about same-sex family. Two women have a little girl as their daughter. And people have challenged that book and tried to get it out of schools and libraries because they feared that just reading that book, exposure to that book, might turn their child into a gay person. You know, and the same.
Like,
same
and that. That's, but that shows a basic not understanding of how gay works.
Right.
I don't know how else to put it. It's like.
Well, yeah. I mean, and of course, it comes out of fear. I mean, you have to be fearful.
Yeah, but it comes out of fear and ignorance.
Ignorance, absolutely. Yeah. You know, sometimes when you act out of fear, you're blinded and unable to think clearly. And it could come from a religious, you know, antipathy to gay life, or whatever. But that's been a pattern. And the same happened to the book about, also a picture book for young children, called Entango Makes Three, about
right,
two
right.
male penguins who came together at the zoo in Central Park, in a sort of a parental relationship to it.
That the authors of that are Justin Richardson and Peter Parnell.
Yes.
And first of all, that's based on a real incident.
Yes,
that
right.
happened, where the two male penguins hooked up, and couldn't produce an egg. Adopted sort of a rock, and then they gave it an egg.
That's right.
And it hatched, and then they had a family, and so somebody actually asked them why couldn't they write a book about it. And as a matter of fact, that happens several times where authors are asked, you know, why can't you write a book about this? Because this is what's happening.
That's right.
And boy, the things that people say about that book just are so off the mark, so out of, and it's also not in context with contemporary society.
Right. I mean, that book and Heather Has Two Mommies have both been extremely controversial, you know, like lightning rods for objections, but also very, very popular. I mean, they both
yeah.
had.
Well, Heather Has Two Mommies has been referenced in all sorts of shows, like The Simpsons and stuff like that. I mean, Heather Has Two Mommies is now like a rock star book.
That's right. And to go back to something we said a little while ago, books like that are great for starting conversations, you know, and conversations about complicated topics. And they sort of distill a question or an issue or a life possibility into a form where a parent and a child can talk about it together. And you would think that, you know, what could be better than that?
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Leonard S. Marcus, one of the world's leading writers about children's books and the people who create them. He's a writer, essayist, interviewer, and teacher, and we're talking about a really great, fascinating book that he has compiled and edited. You can't say that. Writers for Young People talk about censorship, free expression, and the stories they have to tell. Leonard, it's interesting the other reasons why books were attempted to be censored or banned. One of them sort of gets down to it's too urban. This is a different story than what we were talking about before, because this is like one of those code words for race issues.
Exactly. And that's another reason why I found it so hard to sort of untangle the story of censorship in America, because often the stated objection to a book is, you can, you know, surmise, not the deepest or the true reason for objecting. And urban is a code word, and often it goes back to race or ethnicity. And for example, Meg Medina, who is Cuban American, wrote a book called Yaqui Delgado Wants to Kick Your Ass. That was the title.
It's a great title.
Yeah, I thought so. And I mean, and her editor did. She was actually a little bit scared of it at first. And it's the first sentence of the book, and she wasn't going to change that. But she thought, this is going to really turn off a lot of the gatekeepers, the librarians and people who buy the books, and it's going to be hard to stand up at a school assembly and say the title without having, you know, 400 kids giggling or jumping out of their seats. But she realized that she was really, it's a book about bullying, and she was writing it for the kids, not for the adults who were going to, you know, pass judgment before it got to the kids. So she decided to take a chance, and it worked out very well. But she said that, you know, as a Latina girl and then woman growing up in America, she was often regarded as someone who was, you know, likely to say coarse things, not be, you know, smooth and sophisticated in the kind of mainstream American way. So any false move that she might make, you know, in one of her books or in public appearances, were she was coming at it without the benefit of the doubt of some of the members of the audience. So she was very mindful of these code words and decided to not to be cowed by it, because she said, if you're writing a book about bullying, you have to use the language of bullying,
right,
for the kids to relate to it, and to also to kind of sort of drain those words of their power for the reader. Which is, I think, one of the great things that some of the books that were written by her and other people I've interviewed have to offer children. I mean, these kids are sometimes in really difficult situations in which they feel very much alone. And a book has one power that books do have. It can't turn you gay if you're not gay, but it can make you realize you're not alone with something
that's a great concern
to you.
How did the authors often find out that their books were banned?
That's a good question, and there's no one answer to it. Some publishers are very proactive about responding to challenges when they hear about it, and sometimes they see it as part of their role to let the author know. But they're also, the authors are not the best defenders of their own books in that particular situation. The organizations that exist, like the American Library Association and PEN, which is a very old and distinguished writers group, and the National Coalition Against Censorship, they are populated by First Amendment lawyers who have a lot of experience with these situations. And very often what they will do, the author may be notified and then offer to write a letter explaining why the book is the way it is. That's why in the subtitle of my book, the subtitle ends with that it's about the stories they have to tell. Mm-hmm. Have meaning they wrote what they felt impelled to write, because it was, you know, the true story they wanted to tell. So authors are sometimes called upon to explain themselves, you know, their motives for writing the book, and to show that they're not really the pornographers that they're being portrayed as by some people in the community. But the lawyers then, you know, present a strong argument for why it's actually against the Constitution to pull a book capriciously out of a school or library because somebody has decided it goes against their ideas about what is good in the world.
You have several, and we've already mentioned a few, really famous authors, or their books are rather famous. Catherine Patterson is one of them. The Bridge to Terabithia, 1977 that was written. Mm-hmm. And she also had problems with, I think, the great Gilly Hopkins.
Yes.
Now, the problems of what? Language?
Well, again, you know, what did people say and what did they really mean? Language, in her case, was often mentioned as a reason for objecting to her books. Gilly Hopkins is about an orphan, you know, who's taken in by various families along the way, but is, you know, is really being kicked around in life, and is not a sweet little girl. She just isn't. And Catherine Patterson said in her interview that if she didn't put the words in Gilly's mouth that such a child was likely to speak, no one, you know, would be able to relate, who was actually in that situation or could imagine being in that situation, which is could be anybody, you know, would be able to really understand what was at stake. So language, for sure. In the case of the Bridge to Terabithia, it's about two children who are boy-girl, really good friends at, I think, the age of 11, and one of the characters dies suddenly in an accident. And it happens so shockingly, I mean, not in the sense of, you know, like a Freddy Krueger movie, but you're not expecting it, and then she dies. And some people thought that children were not able to cope emotionally with an incident as intense as that in a novel for them, at, you know, middle grade novel. So that was another reason for objecting to Catherine's work. But she's always been a novelist, kind of committed to emotional realism, psychological realism, and she really understands the child's point of view. And so she was determined to be true to her sense of what would be most appropriate.
Thank God you included Dave Pilkey, by the way, because some of the essays, you know, you sort of find yourself getting infuriated as you read. Then you get to Dave Pilkey, and the objections become absolutely silly. And it's amazing. For people who don't know, it's a whole series of graphic books, right?
Yes.
The adventure.
Maybe 64 yep. pages. And they're
it's the Adventure of Captain Underpants series.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the objections, and first of all, his attitude towards everything was really pretty good too. But like there was like this complaint that it's just filled with fart jokes.
Yeah.
And he actually sort of went through the whole series and counted actually how many fart jokes there were, which wasn't that many.
No. Well, so, I mean, that illustrates the fact that there's a lot of projection that goes on when people are somehow frightened by a book or ticked off by it and try to get it out of children's hands. What is very true of his books is that they're irreverent and they make fun of authority when it's misused.
Yep, yep.
You know, the kind of stern, unsympathetic principal or teacher, school teacher that everybody has, you know, encountered at one time or another, and maybe has no tolerance for a child who's different. I mean, Dave Pilkey himself had trouble, attention deficit issues, and, you know, 40 years ago, people didn't know what to do with somebody like that, and he ended up drawing comics off in a corner when, you know, the teachers would ignore him in every other way. So it planted the seed for his career. But, you know, but his books are full of jokes and truisms about social life at school that kids just can't get enough
well,
of.
Well, you know, of all the authors, and maybe including all the other authors, but he knows how to write to an audience.
Absolutely, yeah. No, he's a master.
That's right. I mean, he's writing for people who really know and enjoy his books.
Yeah, and, you know, the funny thing is, I'll give you an example from another country. When Pippi Longstocking was first published in Sweden, I think in the late 40s, the first reaction of the school teachers there was, you know, this is terrible because Pippi Longstocking doesn't live with her parents. She has a horse that she takes into the house, which of which she is the, you know, the sole, it's, the house is just her own. She doesn't go to school. She eats as much candy as she wants. I mean, she's like a terrible example. But what the teachers, to their great credit in Sweden, quickly recognized was children just kept reading these books, reading and reading. And they put together the fact that their goal as teachers was to encourage reading, and the fact that this, right, these books, this series of books, was accomplishing their job much better than they had ever figured out how to do it. So they embraced the books. And, I mean, certainly some teachers around America and parents, I mean, the sales figures are staggering for Dave Pilkey, have understood that having their kids read these books is a positive thing. But so that you find the occasional objector who doesn't get it.
Well, this brings up an interesting question. How many of these books that are, your authors wrote were banned abroad?
To my knowledge, not many, but one that I know was banned in Singapore is It's Perfectly Normal, which is okay. by Roby Harris,
right.
And it's a nonfiction book about human sexuality aimed at children starting at about the age of 8 or so. And that was a book that some people in Singapore felt you know, was, in a sense, preempting the parents' right to have control over their children's knowledge about human sexuality. And for a time, it was yanked from the library there. But it caused such an uproar that they eventually had to back down and restore the book, which is often what does happen.
Well, there's so much in these interviews that are really fascinating, including what inspired them to become writers and all sorts of... There's interesting personal stories in each one of these interviews. My guest tonight has been Leonard S. Marcus, one of the world's leading writers about children's books and the people who write them. He's a writer, essayist, interviewer, and teacher, and we've been talking about his book. I found it a really interesting read. He's compiled and edited a series of interviews called You Can't Say That, Writers for Young People Talk About Censorship, Free Expression, and the Stories They Have to Tell. Leonard, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Mark. Same here.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.